Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right.
I hope you won't mind my resorting to George Carlin once again to make the big point of this week's show here on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Sometimes you just have to go back to the master to get regrounded, and he does it so brilliantly. Hello once again. This is Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, with another provocative report on what's happening with and to our money. Carlin made a couple of key points that will prepare you for what Ellen will be discussing today with our guest, Stephen Lendman, who will be giving you some alarming overviews and counterviews that challenge the uninformed, uncritical knowledge accepted by the mass of citizens who go along with whatever they hear on the mainstream media, or, as Paul Craig Roberts likes to call them, the prestitute media. Today's focus is on the expanding international trend by global bankers and their political allies to eliminate cash from the Western world stage in order to prevent individuals from removing their assets from filling big banks. Though that's not how they'll describe this action. The idea is that if money is only available to consumers as digital entries on bank balance sheets, then people won't be able to withdraw it if they get wind of a bank failure, and it can thereby be confiscated when necessary as digits in order to rebalance that bank's books. Based on Ellen's comments, it seems like global bank failures seem to be an event that the oligarchs are preparing for, with one such person from the Bank of International Settlements suggesting that the bail-ins will be on a scale unimagined before. Such a collapse, as Ellen will point out in a moment, might appear imminent based on the widely circulated comments that were going around at the Davos Forum in January and the policies that have been enacted in recent years by key banking fortresses such as the European Central Bank, the FDIC, the Fed, SEC, and others. But what's the point about critical thinking that Carlin refers to? Well, one need only look at the myths that circulate around many international affairs that don't hold up under scrutiny, and yet are adopted by mainstream media sources who toe the lines of their employers, the big corporate and banking interests. In other words, things are frequently not as they appear, and to get an informed, critical view of what's happening in your world requires more than just mimicking the company line, so to speak. So when Carlin says they own you, he's not being flip. They actually do own us, because we're trapped in a world of debt that they control and they issue. This is the core point about our work. We've given away our right to issue our money and are obliged to borrow it from the private speculating gamblers who destroyed much of the world's economy not so many years ago, devastating the lives of millions around the world, and who are now preparing to grab their next round of assets from all of us when their house of cards, make that our house of financial cards, is laid low once again. As Carlin says, well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everyone else. Actually, he was being a little conservative. It seems clear that they don't just want more. They want it all. So when you listen to Ellen's conversation with Stephen Lendman, keep in mind that there is a macro game underway, a larger strategy at work that drives events such as wars and terror events for reasons that are well hidden from mass view. Things are frequently not as they appear, or as you have been told. Ellen's latest article is called Now They're Coming for Your Savings, Negative Interest, Bail-ins, and the War on Cash. Let's talk with her about it.
Your interview with Stephen is very provocative, as is your latest article, and we need to talk about this because to set people up for hearing what you and Stephen are talking about, we have to have a reality check about what's going on with money. You'll be talking about the kind of the global conspiracy, as it were, or as it is, perhaps, about what the dynamic of money is doing to our societies and our cultures. It is shocking. And so your latest article is called Now They're Coming for Your Savings, Negative Interest, Bail-ins, and the War on Cash. And your article spells out the logic that appears to be in play now and being promoted through the media around the idea that cash is bad, it's a way of letting crime run rampant, we've got to bring it in, etc. What's really going on?
Yes, I saw it. One of those arguments for going cashless was that it's dirty and you can get germs off it. So, I mean, we've been using cash for like several hundred years and seem to not have any great epidemics from that. But yeah, so they're clearly up to something else besides what they purport to be up to. At Davos in Switzerland, that's where the big moneyed people come together and discuss the hot topics of the day, and one of their major hot topics was that they needed to go to negative interest, supposedly because central banks have run out of tools, they've run out of bullets, because the way they allegedly get the economy stimulated is by lowering interest rates so more people can borrow. So they borrow in order to shop, and then you get people out there spending their money, and that stimulates the economy. Well, this clearly hasn't worked because they've got the interest rates all the way down to zero and people still aren't out there shopping. Why? Because they don't have the money. Even if, you know, even if they can borrow cheaply, first of all, the banks aren't lending to those people, the 99% or at least like the 90% that just don't qualify for loans. And they don't want to borrow anymore because they've already borrowed so much that they're, you know, just too heavily in debt to even get close to paying this stuff off. So from the point of view of the banks, it's all about debt. It's all about borrowing. The more debt you have, the more borrowing you have, the better, because that means people are out there shopping. But it's not working. So what's it really about? Well, there was something else at Davos that came out. This was said by William White, who was former chief economist of the Bank for International Settlements. He said that some of the biggest European banks are seriously insolvent, that they're not really reporting their liabilities properly, and if they were, they would be bankrupt. And that in order to save these banks, we're going to have some major bail-ins, which means taking the money of depositors. I mean, this would just be the big depositors, but even so, you're going to have riots in the streets when we start seeing a Cyprus-style bail-in all over Europe, which is apparently what they're predicting is liable to happen. He said it's going to be a bail-in like you've never seen before. So you can't have a bail-in unless the money's in the bank, and obviously people will be pulling it out as soon as they hear about it. Just like in 2008, when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, then you had a run on the money markets, and that's actually what crashed the system, where all the people pulled their money out of the money markets, and that's where the banks borrow in order to maintain their liquidity. So when they didn't have that ability to borrow very cheaply to cover the fact that they're lending money they don't really have, then the system collapsed. And so he was predicting that we're going to see something even worse this time around. So to make sure that you don't have a run on the bank where all the big depositors whose money they want to bail in doesn't disappear, go somewhere else, the solution of the day is to go cashless so that there's no such thing as cash, that your only option is to keep your money in the bank. It only exists as digits in a bank. So after January, which is when they all met in Davos, there were all these different instances of recommending going cashless or getting rid of, like, they've gotten rid of the 500 euro note,
right.
And there's talk of getting rid of the $100 bill, which
Larry Summers, I mean, suggesting that, you say.
Yeah, so just think, if there are no $100 bills, I mean, nowadays you pay for your gas with a $100 bill. It's not even a very big bill. So if the only way you can store money under the mattress is in ones and fives and tens, you're going to have a really thick and lumpy mattress, or you're going to have to buy a very large safe. Or it seems to me people would probably go to gold and silver, but you can't really, that's not as liquid as cash, obviously. You can't walk in the grocery store and pay with a bar of silver or gold.
Yeah. So there are no real alternatives. But aren't they also able to close down any alternatives, right? Make it against the law to have cash.
Right. They did it in 1933. They made it against the law to hold gold. So they could certainly do it. They can, and they'll use this excuse that it's necessary to save the economy. But clearly, it's not about saving the economy, because they've already tried put interest rates to zero, and that didn't work. So why would it work to go even below zero? So it's clearly about something else. It's about getting control of our money. And it seems to me it's about getting the money of the people who don't need to borrow. They've already locked all those people into debt at the bottom. You could say the 99%, but at least the 90%, which is what Margaret Kennedy wrote, that 90% of the population were net borrowers and only 10% were net savers.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the people who don't have to borrow. So what they're trying to do is get the money of the people who don't have to borrow. And to do that, they have to go to negative interest and bail-ins, where even though you didn't borrow the money, they're going to find it wherever you've got it, and they're going to get it. So really, it's all about this great parasite, as Michael Hudson's been writing about, that is just eating up the economy until ultimately it will die.
Yeah, it will self-destruct. The franchise of unsustainable interest compounding itself, it'll just devour itself. But Hudson's book is brilliant in describing what a parasite does to insinuate itself into the system unknowing to the host, and then affecting the brain of the host to make it think this is a good thing. And of course, we've all been indoctrinated. We've all drank the Kool-Aid about the money-based system of our economy. We're at a very serious point, it seems to me.
Right. We've all been made to think that we have to bail out these big banks, that if the big banks go, our whole economy will collapse. But there are other ways to do it. One possibility would be to nationalize those big banks. And then the objection to that would be, like in Sweden, they nationalize the big banks, but then what they do is they take over the debts, and the government pays off the debts, and then they hand them back to the private investors. So basically what they've done is just the government has assumed the losses. But what you could do after you nationalize these banks is just write off the debts, because we now know that money was just created on the books in the first place. They don't actually lend their deposits. They create deposits when they make loans. So just write those down to zero, and then arguably the bank will have already spent all the deposit, you know, on their investments or whatever they've done that's gone bad. And so if there's no money there for the depositors, you could still just write that into the accounts, because that's their money. And that was the deal, that these were demand accounts. They could get their deposits on demand. So put that money in there. Would it be inflationary? No, because the depositors would not have any more money than they thought they had. So it's not like they're going to going to rush out and spend money they weren't going to spend before. And the other money, the money that went for the loans that didn't get paid back, it's already out there. So if it's going to push up prices, it's already happened, and it didn't happen. And the reason is there is not enough money in the whole system. It's the nature of our parasitic system that there's never enough money, that they keep it intentionally short of money so that people will have to continually have to borrow.
Right. Yeah, so the war on cash is underway, and the new Canadian budget has a bail-in provision as part of it, codifying the idea of bail-ins, just like everybody else. This is now the way of the world. So when money disappears and is not available to people, where does that leave us?
Well, it leaves us enslaved to the system. So here we see the news is all about, you know, the primaries and these sort of little arguments among the candidates. And Brussels, of course, the Brussels terrorist attack, which sounds terrible. But your odds of being in a terrorist attack are slim to none, whereas your odds of losing your money if we have major bailouts that trigger major panic and send us into a 1930s-style depression, those odds are very high. So we need to understand what's going on and step up and do something about it while we still can. Yeah. Or arguably, maybe it's going to take a crisis in order to wake people up, and then we'll step up and change the system. I don't know. But hopefully, we can turn a crisis into opportunities.
Yeah, I guess the first step is to tell the truth about it, or at least to be able to identify that we are in a crisis. And I think that that is one of the very good reasons of the value of listening to your interview with Stephen Lendman, because he, as an older gentleman, has seen this all before in one form or another, and pulls no punches, has just no question of that the crisis is a contrivance to prop up the oligarchic wealth machine, the franchise of debt, and that they will go to any length to pursue it. As George Carlin said at the outset of the show, they want it all. Well, Ellen, I'm looking forward to hearing what Stephen has to say. May as well get to it.
Okay. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
My guest today is Stephen Lendman, a prolific writer and formerly a syndicated columnist, activist, news TV personality, and radio talk show host. His radio show, the Progressive Radio News Hour, began on the Progressive Radio Network in 2007. He has had to discontinue the show, unfortunately, due to health issues, but he is still very actively writing. And lately, he's been writing on the Brussels attacks and the war on terrorism. Greetings, Stephen. It's so great to be talking to you.
Oh, Ellen, it's a joy to be on with you. It really is, and to be on PRN as well.
Oh, yeah. You interviewed me once a month for a couple of years, I think, and I really appreciated that. You were so supportive and easy to talk to. And so.
Oh, you were one of my regulars, and I always look forward to getting together with you.
Oh, thanks. So you recently wrote on the Brussels attacks and the questions surrounding them. I have some questions, too. But first, I should say why this is relevant to our money, which is supposed to be the theme of this show. The terrorist attacks that we've seen lately have all been blamed on the Islamic State, or ISIS. And it declares as one of its goals to replace the corrupt usury-based dollar, as they say, and our banking system with usury-free banking and the gold dinar, which they've actually started issuing it. Qaddafi was doing the same thing in Africa, and we now know that was at least one reason he was taken down, because it was actually confirmed in Hillary Clinton's emails that were released recently. My latest article was actually on that. And Iran has an independent central bank, and it was targeted by U.S. sanctions, or U.S. banks, or banks trading in the U.S. were not allowed to have dealings with the Iranian central bank. So clearly, Western bankers are seeing Islamic banking as a threat to their own model. But the question is whether the Islamic State was really responsible for the terrorist attacks, or even who is the Islamic State. The attacks could be false flag operations designed to create a military enemy, justifying aggressive counterterrorism, which we certainly are engaging in. So I'll just say one more thing on that, and then you can have at it. We've gotten so suspicious of these terrorist attacks that nowadays you see blogs and videos like within hours that say that they're false flag operations. In fact, video techniques have gotten so sophisticated that we really can't believe what we see anymore on the internet. I recently saw a video of giraffes that were lining up to a diving board and doing flips off it. It was so realistic you would have sworn that these were real giraffes. And then, of course, there are these teams of crisis actors that are advertised on the internet. Like, you can actually hire these crisis actors to stage a terrorist attack, and supposedly it's to train first responders. But the point is that you can fake anything these days. So we don't trust what we see. We don't trust what we read. We don't trust the mainstream media anymore because they're notorious for distorting things. And they don't do independent investigation like they used to. They just go with the official report. And we don't trust the officials anymore. So anyway, that's my rant-like introduction. So what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, Ellen, one thing popped into my mind immediately about the don't trust anything you see. A line from a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, I believe it was HMS Pinafore, that goes, if I get it exactly right, nothing is as it seems, skim milk masquerades as cream. Well, I mean, anything you see on a scoundrel media television, as I like to call it, or in the scoundrel media, whether it's television or the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, my three favorite print journals to media to beat up on, and all television news, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, CBS, NBC, and so on, nothing you get through these outlets is believable. You're getting propaganda. You're getting what these people want you to believe. And another big issue in my mind, absolutely related to money, Ellen, as to why these attacks go on, labeled terrorist attacks, is the justifications for the unjustifiable, waging aggressive wars against one country after another. And wars are all about power and money and profit. The defense contractors profit hugely. The banks profit hugely. The technology companies profit hugely. The toilet paper companies profit hugely. Everybody profits from wars except the people getting killed and maimed and so on. And these wars in the post 9/11 climate, we see all this stuff going on, wars against Muslim countries, but they could be somebody else. Muslims are the enemy of choice today, replacing communists a generation ago that lasted from the Russian Revolution in 1917 to Soviet Russia's dissolution in 1991. America needs enemies. Ellen, and when you lose one, you have to create another. And for a short period, Saddam came right out of room service, and then we got rid of him, and the war on Islam began raging at home and abroad. And people should realize that all of the prisoners before and still at Guantanamo, they're all Muslims. I think they're all men. Some of them were very young. Some were boys when they were brought there. I don't know what the ages are of the people still there. But Guantanamo was the tip of the iceberg. There were these torture prisons, America's gulag, on a worldwide basis. And all the prisoners in them are Muslims. But it's part of the war on terror, which is a complete fabrication, justifying the wars of aggression, which are very, very real, with all of the horrors going on with them. And if that isn't related to money, Ellen, I don't know what is. And I truly believe, based on the evidence that I've seen so far, that what happened in Brussels on Tuesday was a false flag. There's no question. The evidence is beyond overwhelming that 9/11 was the mother of all false flags. The Paris bombings in November last year, overwhelming evidence, a false flag. San Bernardino incidents, the couple that were blamed for it had nothing to do with it. The Boston bombings in 2013, close to my heart, Ellen, because I was born in Boston, and I know the precise spot where the bombings took place. I was there so many times. Again, a false flag. The Tazunov brothers, I'm mispronouncing their name, had nothing whatsoever to do with them. One of them was killed by the police. The other one still alive, and the comments he's made that have leaked out have been suppressed by the media, including a conversation I remember writing about him telling his mother that he had nothing to do with what happened. And that's right, he had nothing to do with what happened. But all this stuff stokes fear and justifies the idea that America can go to war with anybody, Ellen.
Mm-hmm. And it justifies a police state, which
yes.
You can imagine. Let's assume that the whole banking system collapses, for example, as it would have in 2008, except that the government bailed the banks out, and now the governments have said no more bailouts, or certainly the U.S. has, and so we'll go into bail-ins, which means confiscating people's deposits. And you can just imagine there would be riots in the streets if that happened. So whoever they is, has to ensure that there's a police state in place to prevent the riots that are more and more happening around the world due to oppressed economic conditions. The fact that there is no longer a middle class, everybody is now in the lower class unless you're in the upper class. I mean, there's a great divide between classes. Then now there's a war on savers. I was just going to write on that next, like the 10% that are considered savers, 90% according to Margaret Kennedy, and her figures are probably old by now, but 90% are net borrowers, like they always have to continually borrow in order to meet their expenses, and only 10% are net savers. So how do you get the money of the savers? You have to go after them with bail-ins and negative interest rates, so you actually take some of their deposits, going cashless so that all money is digital, so your money doesn't even exist unless it's in a bank, and therefore they can be sure that you can't take it and run and put it under your mattress.
And as you've explained, Ellen, put your money in the bank. It's not your money anymore. It's the bank's money, and all you have is an IOU.
And our whole money system is based on debt. So we now know that banks create all of our money, but the only way that they can create it is if somebody borrows it. So they have to continually have a supply of borrowers. And so it's a known fact that the whole third world has been locked into debt through our banks or through the IMF, which is even worse, because if you're in debt to a bank, even an international bank, if you go broke, you just don't pay it and you just go bankrupt. But if you're in debt to the IMF, you have to agree to all these austerity measures. So if you're a government, you sell off your public assets, cut back on public services, etc. So that whole debt system is what keeps this quadrillion-dollar derivative scheme afloat, for example. That's where they get their money to invest in all these things, is that it's all based on loans and debt, and so you have to keep this debt machine going. So anything that threatens that, as Gaddafi was doing in Africa, for example, where he was threatening to give Africans their own banking system and their own money, so that they didn't have to borrow internationally. That's clearly a threat to the existing system.
And I think Saddam had independent ideas as well. Not necessarily the same ones as Gaddafi, but he also was independent, I believe, of the Western banking system, and a big reason why he was targeted for regime change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you say about communism, I mean, they had communism as an enemy, but now there are no... I mean, unless they were to go after China, and everybody's afraid, I'm sure they're afraid to actually attack China, and China's not even communist anymore, so there really is no communism to attack. So you need something amorphous that can be anywhere and that gives you an excuse to attack anywhere, and terrorism is the perfect scapegoat, whatever.
Oh, it absolutely is. It's so easy to fool the public, no matter how many times they've been fooled before, and then realize that they were fooled. You can come right back again and fool them again. Again, they're so gullible, they fall for anything. So you can convince people that giving up your freedoms is a good thing for security that, of course, you'll never get. You'll get a police state instead of freedoms, and people go along with this and think this is okay. And I remember after the Boston bombing, things. I mean, there were terrible things going on in the greater Boston area, pre-dawn raids on homes in various neighborhoods, and people supported this kind of stuff, thinking that they were safer because these police state practices were going along. So you literally can convince people that it's okay to be your own hangman and say, oh, bravo, continue it. We love this stuff. Just absolutely amazing, but this stuff goes on so that the people running the country could come up with the most diabolical schemes imaginable and get the majority of the public either to go along with it or not resist it. And the ones who do resist it, we've got the police state there to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. And I think Henry Kissinger said something to that effect, like, was it in 1991 or at a Bilderberger meeting, something like today, that people would resist if there were no tanks coming into the city. But tomorrow they'll welcome it because of all this terror. You know, you cheer when the tanks come in. Yeah, horrible.
I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. I consider just local police forces, including Chicago, which is a very brutal force, mostly against minority people, poor people. In downtown Chicago, where I live, the cops are pretty benign. I mean, they will go to help people because that's an upscale community. But you get a mile away and heading mostly west from where I live. I'm on the lakefront, so you can't go east. You got to go west, but just not too far. I mean, within walking distance of where I live, the communities can be very, very badly oppressed by the cops. And you don't see anything going on complaining about this. And if people get shot and killed in these communities, they don't even ripple in the media. Practically nothing said about it. Once in a while, there's a big issue made about something, but that's the exception that proves the rule. There's violence every day in Chicago and other big cities, and it goes right under the radar and nobody notices. And I think it can only get worse ahead, Ellen, with the horrors that are going on and the poverty that's growing, and the idea that America has 5% unemployment. What a bunch of rubbish. 23% unemployment. I mean, we're in the Great Depression, but nobody reports it as the Great Depression. But it is the Great Depression for the majority of people in the country. And I can remember writing about census data saying half the households in America are either impoverished or bordering on it, and they survive because they have two or more rotten jobs. This wasn't the country I grew up in, Ellen, or the one you grew up in.
Yeah, and they're the equivalent of terrorist attacks that we perpetrate in the Middle East every day, different bombings, and those don't get reported. But when it happens in Brussels, then it means this is a declaration of world war against the Islamic State, which it wasn't even actually well proven that that's who did it. And even if they did do it, who are they? Who is ISIS? Were they not somebody that we created when we created Al-Qaeda in 1989 to fight the Russians in Afghanistan? So you're kind of an expert on all of that.
Well, I'm not an expert, but you've got it exactly right. The Mujahideen going back to the 1980s in Afghanistan against Soviet Russia, and then we had Al-Qaeda. And the names don't really mean anything. They're all the same thing, but they have different names. Just like a baseball league. You know, they're all baseball players. But the teams have different names and different color uniforms or whatever. But they're all the same. It's the same thing with these terrorist groups and attacks. And there are countless numbers of these so-called terrorist groups. Russia has come up with maybe a couple of hundred different terrorist offshoot groups in Syria alone. So who knows the names of these groups, or even if they have names. But I'll come flat out and say, Ellen, that the Islamic State, what I like to call ISIS, had absolutely nothing to do with what happened in Brussels. And the so-called tape claiming ISIS saying they wanted to set up a caliphate and so on and so forth. You and I can make a tape and make the same statement, and the media reports it as gospel truth. We already know that the so-called videotapes of the alleged bombers at the Brussels airport, they were tapes that were made about 4 or 5 years ago, I think in Russia. They had nothing to do with Brussels. So we already know the fix is in, and the official story is a bald-faced lie. And again, America created ISIS. The Western countries support ISIS. Why on earth would ISIS want to attack its paymaster? Does anybody think in terms like that?
Mm-hmm. And why would you want to attack Brussels? I don't see what they would supposedly get out of it. You can more see what the police state would get out of it.
I think the reason for Brussels, two things, home of the EU and home of NATO. Maybe that's the symbolism behind Brussels.
But, I mean, if you're the Islamic State and you're really trying to spread your message, whatever it is, and you'd say your religion, as Kevin Barrett points out, he's got a PhD in Islamic studies, and he says that absolutely terrorism is un-Islam. You know, it's, you can't be Muslim and be a terrorist, because if you kill any innocent people, I think there's this one passage that gets misinterpreted all the time, something about waging war against infidels. But actually, I had this also explained by a British Muslim man who had, you know, converted to Islam. He's Welsh, actually. And he explained that what the passage really says, that I guess Muhammad had said something to the effect of, you can't kill. And somebody said, well, what about if somebody's trying to kill you? You know, can you kill in self-defense? And he said, yeah, well, that's okay in self-defense. So, you know, there's that. And if you ever look at the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, I mean, God, you know, Jehovah tells the Jews to go out and sort of rape and pillage indiscriminately against all the non-Jews. So, I mean, there are things written in scriptures that people don't actually subscribe to or make it part of their religion. But my point is that they're always linking Islamic terrorists together as if terrorism is part of Islam, but it's not. It's absolutely not. It's a very peaceful religion, actually.
It very much is, and people should realize, but they don't, that the roots of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity are virtually identical, but there are always offshoot groups and radicalized people, which really has nothing to do with religion and everything to do with the warped ideology of these people, whatever they believe in. It certainly has nothing to do with thou shalt not kill and honor, love thy neighbor, and so on and so forth. You know, I mean, this right out of Christianity, and the Jewish ideology is basically the same thing. The stuff that I was taught as a boy growing up in Hebrew school and getting bar mitzvah and so on and so forth. But you get crazies and lunatics and so on. But it's even worse when you get the CIA recruiting mercenaries to be radicalized extremists and teaching them how to kill and how to lop off heads and how to use chemical weapons. That's where they really get bad. You know, people don't just internalize this stuff and go out and become bad guys. You have to teach them to be bad guys. And there are plenty of teachers around, and I'm afraid most of them are in the West.
Yeah, and you have to arm them and you have to fund them.
It's a very ugly situation, and I'm very, very fearful. I've said many times in articles, Ellen, we had two world wars. Is it unreasonable to think we won't have a third one? And the weapons we have today, the ones we had back then for one and two, my dad was in World War I, came back in one piece, but the weapons back then were toys compared to the stuff we have now. If there's another world war and it involves Russia and America, I quoted Hyman Rickover, the founder of America's nuclear navy, saying, when nations go to war with each other to win, they'll use whatever weapons they have to do it. You know, if you can win without nuclear weapons, so be it. But if it takes nuclear weapons to win, you use them. And if there's a nuclear war, well, we know it's going to be the end of that. Everybody loses, including humanity.
And I don't think when we say America did it, or, you know, it's not us. It's certainly not we the people. There's somebody behind the military that's even more powerful than the president. I remember reading that Clinton said, gee, I thought when I got to be president, I'd be making the decisions.
Literally, though, the strings were attached to him the first day in the Oval Office, and the puppet master was pulling them. Oh, yeah, I think there's an embedded power structure in the country, Ellen. And, you know, it's the big moneyed interest, the banks and the rest of them, and the war profiteers and the Monsantos and so on and so forth. These are the people, the Bilderberg Group and the George Soros crowd, and they're pulling the strings, and they decide who's going to be president, number one, and number two, what the policies will be once an individual gets to the office. And I think the reason there's a lot of concern about Trump is he's a billionaire businessman used to doing things on his own, and I think the power brokers aren't sure they can control him if he becomes president. I mean, he'll do the same dirty stuff as everybody else, but, you know, he'll just decide what he wants to do, and he's not going to let some other billionaire push him around.
Well, and he said he would investigate 9/11, I mean, and he's not regard the big banks as his friend. It could be very interesting. It could be an interesting shakeup.
I think if he really decided he was going to investigate 9/11 for real, which really wouldn't be very hard to investigate at this point, there's so much evidence, but I think he would be a Jack Kennedy number two. Well, in Kennedy's case, he wanted to get out of Vietnam. That was the main reason. A lot of other reasons, but that was the main one. Bobby, one of the reasons for killing him was the fear he might investigate why Jack was killed. He had the same ideology, anti-war position, as his brother, I believe. So you can't have people like this running the country. You need maniacs. And I think the feeling about Bernie Sanders is, I don't think he'd be any different from Trump or Clinton, basically. You know, around the edges there'd be some differences, but the big stuff basically would be the same thing. But he sounds populist, so he sounds like maybe he wouldn't be as 100% true blue by the pure evil standards. So you don't want a guy like this around. You want a real true blue standard bearer, and that's Hillary Clinton. And I do fear she's going to be the next president. Oh, it's a very dangerous world, and I'm afraid that the money changers have things under their control, and they'll do whatever they want.
Throw it up, yeah. Well, and that's what I've always written about, that the source of their power. My first 10 books were on health and the pharmaceutical industry and the cancer industry and, you know, corruption there. But when I realized that they were the same cartel as the banking industry, and it was through the banks that they got their power, because the banks had the power to create money. That's when I switched over to writing about banking. I mean, the way to get our power back is we have to get the power to create our own money back, which means having our own publicly owned banks, which I've actually spoken 4 times in Malaysia at RIBA-free conferences. These are usury-free conferences, even though a publicly owned bank would charge interest. You know, I've never said it. I mean, if we follow the Bank of North Dakota model, it's just a bank like any other bank, except that we own the thing and the profits go back to the people. But actually, the RIBA-free thing, the Muslim thing, is against exploitation. So if you return the profits to the people, you're not exploiting the people. So that actually works within their system. So it seems to me, since we have virtually no control at the federal level, where we're working now is on cities and counties. They can set up their own banks, and then at least they'll be safe against bail-ins, because the local governments will be safe against bail-ins. I think they're a major target right now, is to get their money, which is in the big Wall Street banks. And, you know, they'll turn the money to keep the money within the community, which is what the Bank of North Dakota is all about. North Dakota is a very Republican state, so it's not about socialism. It's about state sovereignty, keeping our money to be used for our purposes, recirculating it back to the people for the benefit of the people, but using this power to create money as credit, which is what all banks do.
Well, you and I are absolutely on the same page when it comes to public banking, Ellen. It doesn't solve all problems, but it would solve so many. And just on the health issue for a moment, a few months ago I wrote an article about drug industry banditry. I discovered that an ointment that I need for a skin condition that was reasonably priced when I began using it, well under $100. The last time I bought it, I had my dermatologist get a substitute for me. It was very expensive, but not as expensive as the one I've been using. It literally, the price went up to $500. So it increased more than fivefold in just a few years of my use. And I saw something only recently that since Obamacare came into force, 2011, I believe, drug prices have essentially doubled.
Wow. And then you used to be able to get all these drugs in Mexico, for example, very cheaply, that were more expensive in the U.S. But if they passed the TPP and the TISA, the Trade and Services Agreement, all that stuff is going to be standardized, which means everybody will be paying huge prices.
And what do people do if they can't afford the stuff? In my case, I'm on Medicare, but I'm not on Part D, so I have no drug coverage. And what do people do if they can't afford to pay for these drugs? Here I had a simple ointment that, you know, I mean, an ointment, how much can an ointment be? My God, I mean, to get a price that an awful lot of people could not afford to pay, and that ointment was very, very important for me. As miserable as I was at times using the ointment, it would have been absolutely horrific if I hadn't had the use of it. And a lot of people would have a condition like mine, and they couldn't afford the drug.
Right.
The drug companies and the war profiteers and the banks and the rest of them, they're the ones that run the country, as we know, Ellen, and that's the problem. And with the money control system that has to change, I don't know how we get it to change, Ellen. I mean, winning the battle at the grassroots, you know, one village and town and city at a time, if that's possible. But, you know, even if there's progress made on that, we don't have the Marines or nuclear weapons. So, I mean, these so-and-sos can do anything they want to us.
But I think that's why they're so big on a national security state now, or a police state, is because people are waking up that the real solution is to wake everybody up. If you had a serious, well, as Henry Ford said, if people understood, it is well that people don't understand money and banking, because if they did, there would be a revolution before morning. Not that we want a violent revolution, but if everybody knew what was going on, you wouldn't be able to hoodwink most of the people who only get their news from TV.
I would hope not, but I get very discouraged about the U.S. public that seems either unknowledgeable or indifferent. And once in a while, when I'm taking treatment, I'm around nurses and attendants and so on, and you're just lying there. You know, you're getting an infusion or something or other, and it takes time. And once in a while, I'll just make a comment or two about what's going on to the world to one of the nurses who's administering the stuff to me. And usually I get in return glazed eyes, not having any idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
and that's the problem.
We'll probably take a crisis, as they say. The crisis will probably be engineered, and it will be probably intended to lock in the police state, but hopefully we can turn the crisis to our advantage. I was thinking of writing a whole series based on the Hunger Games. Supposedly, 1984 was the 20th century version of the police state controlled by Big Brother with a big TV screen type thing. In fact, the original was Charlie Chaplin. It's the one where he's on the assembly line, and he's like, he's become a machine himself virtually, but he's taking a break in the bathroom, and there's a big TV up there, or a screen, you know, and telling him to get back to work because he was taking a cigarette break in the bathroom. Anyway, so in the Hunger Games, the heroes turn the thing around by actually using the TV to create a revolution. So that hopefully that's the stage we're at, where we can turn it around by using their crisis to wake people up.
There are plenty of very savvy tech people around, the hackers and so on, that maybe at some point we could use cyberspace so that no matter what they do, there are people on the other side of the issues that have as much expertise as they do, and they can fight fire with fire and literally wake up an awful lot of people to want to do something. I mean, either we change the system at some point, Ellen, we're really heading for God only knows what, unless a world war ends it for all of us. But it's not the country I grew up in, it's not the country I like living in, and I fear for young people who I don't, for most of them, the vast majority of them, have nothing to look forward to when they grow up.
Mm-hmm. But the young people are also our hope, because they seem to be
very
awake to what's going on, yeah, and trying to do something about it, which is good. I mean, that's the whole Bernie Sanders has captured the youth.
I think a good start would be to awaken people to the fact that every time they see an alleged terrorist attack, like when one out in Brussels, just don't believe the official story. And what I say to people all the time is, ignore what the major media tell you. Ignore what the politicians tell you. Use independent sources, reliable independent sources only, for your information. And it's so accessible. 15 minutes a day, people can know enough about what's going on to understand the state of the world, instead of wasting your time watching television that is literally there to propagandize you and feed you with an awful lot of misinformation so you know nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to agree. It's just been marvelous talking to you, and I'm glad you seem to be doing better.
Oh, thank you, Ellen. It's a joy to be on with you anytime, and a joy to have me a time on PRN.
Thanks
Ellen.
I've been speaking with Stephen Lenman, writer, syndicated columnist, formerly radio talk show host on PRN.
Now we're going to take a couple of minutes and talk with Matt Stannard about the Public Banking Institute's rather exciting new project called What Wall Street Costs America, an aggregated look at how much money is going to Wall Street from their city, county, and or state, to get a sense of the predatory relationships that exist across the country as money gets sucked out of localities and moved into the global banking marketplace.
Well, Matt, What Wall Street Costs America is this project that is very timely. given not only the sentiment in the country, but also the severe challenge that Wall Street poses to sustained health and well-being of cities and counties and states around the country. As the debts to Wall Street get larger and larger, and the prospects for handling issues for the people become smaller and smaller. This project really intends to open a new national conversation for the public, right?
One of the things that both surprise and kind of impress and challenge me is that although some really savvy journalists and researchers have been telling us that this has been a problem for actually quite some time, almost 6 years now, since some of the very first stories broke, particularly about the fees that are being paid by municipalities to Wall Street. But in spite of that, this is one of those things that the general public really does not have a lot of knowledge about unless they've happened upon the work of David Sirota, Matt Taibbi, Saqib Bhatti, and other equally fine journalists and researchers. Once people have, then they do get a knowledge of that, and of course people are very angry about it and very open to new ways of conceiving funding and financing for our public entities. But until people really get that data in front of them and really get those narratives in front of them, it's not something that people think about. They just don't think that Salt Lake City, Utah, or Omaha, Nebraska has some sort of relationship with Wall Street and that that relationship on the part of Wall Street is predatory. I think most people don't understand how much our states and cities depend on those central, huge private financiers.
So in what ways do cities, counties, and states then use Wall Street, and how big have these numbers gotten?
The numbers have gotten quite big, and the way that they use them, there are several conduits, a couple of main conduits with which a city might find itself having to pay incredible amounts of money for very little service, really, to Wall Street. Cities and states that don't have their own banks or don't have their own financial services have to turn to these professional services that are based on Wall Street to hold their money, to manage their pension funds, to manage their bonds that they issue for infrastructure improvements and development in cities. And what that all means is that these financial firms charge cities and states to hold our money, also charge cities and states to lend back the money to the cities and states, and also charge the cities and states handling fees, termination fees, and also they tend to make investments that are often very risky. And of course, there's interest rates on top of that. One of the places that we've researched is Jefferson County, Alabama, which has just been a terrible disaster. They defaulted on a $515 million debt to improve their sewers. And the way that happened was, you know, they had to improve their sewer infrastructure in the county. Wall Street salespeople basically bribed local officials and sort of connived the county to fund that sewer project with a series of swap deals that, as Matt Taibbi wrote, essentially pushed the debt into the future, but at a geometrically increasing cost. And Jefferson County is now just emerging from a $4.3 billion bankruptcy that was caused by what Wall Street did in terms of these sewer warrants, basically, which were debts that Wall Street issued for the sewers. So that's one example, but when you add up all of the examples, all of the things that different cities and states are paying in, you know, you're talking about over $1 trillion. You're talking, particularly in terms of fees for pension funds, you're talking about tens of billions of dollars, even in medium-sized cities, hundreds of billions of dollars in bigger cities. Of course, we could talk about New Jersey. In 2014, New Jersey was paying $1.6 million per day in handling fees to Wall Street to manage those pension funds. $1.6 million a day, just about over $600 million in fees just for 2014.
That's stunning. Now, when we say Wall Street banks, it's really with the global banks, isn't it? The large banks.
Yeah, we say Wall Street. In our movement, we tend to say Wall Street, and what we really mean is the global financial network that includes Wall Street, but are really multinational banks.
Right. And many of these funds, the public dollars, are in play in markets around the globe in various ways in which the Wall Street banks put their money to work, so to speak, actually to generate profits. As we like to point out, means that the money's not going to work in the community from which it came. Mm-hmm. So obviously we're setting up this opportunity for people to make the distinction between the relationship between the Wall Street banks for their cities and what local public bank could do through enabling that city money to be kept locally, perhaps even vested locally in local banks instead of the big banks under the right circumstances.
Exactly. So, and that would allow them to utilize fractional reserve lending to provide what those locations need, just as the Bank of North Dakota does now. As I was researching the city of New Orleans, and particularly what the horrible things that happened to New Orleans in the wake of the Hurricane Katrina disaster, I found out that they had, at the time of the disaster, New Orleans had $500 million in bonds for their convention center. They had $200 million in water and sewer bonds. Wipes out property tax base you would expect to pay back those bonds. But instead of having their own bank or a Louisiana State Bank or some sort of Bank of North Dakota style entity that could have given New Orleans immediate relief, instead they had to go get down on their knees and beg J.P. Morgan Chase for an additional $150 million loan to finance their basic services in the wake of the hurricane. And I thought to myself, what an irrational society we live in when a city that's, you know, literally drowning, literally dying, has to go to a big bank and get down on their knees and beg for a loan that's going to put them much more in debt. It's really going to hurt them in the long run, when they should have their own entity, shouldn't they, that would be able to do exactly what the state of North Dakota has done during floods and other disasters that have hurt the people of North Dakota, which is, we can provide you this money, we can do this at low interest or no interest, and the last thing you need to be worrying about right now is getting deeper in debt.
Yeah, the beauty of having a public bank, that's great. Well, the project, What Wall Street Costs America, is going to be opening up a lot of new awarenesses like the ones you've mentioned. And it's not certainly not a top-down campaign, even though the Public Banking Institute is generating it. It's very participatory. And just a couple of the ways in which people can participate, Matt.
The main thing is, we need these types of stories and this type of data from people who live there. They can go to our website and the Wall Street Costs website, and they can get a hold of us with those news stories. It can be things that they find and document in their municipal budgets, in their municipal comprehensive annual financial report. So that's the first thing, is just the information and the narratives. But then we would love for people to get creative. They can send us video files. They can send us audio files. They can send us graphics. And, you know, we will absolutely print, post, and distribute any relevant literature and videos and graphics that we receive, because we would love for people to tell the story of what Wall Street has done to their cities or states right from where they are.
That's great, Matt. We look forward to talking more about the specific outcomes and results that we get in the campaign, the What Wall Street Costs America campaign. Matt, thanks so much for your time and your input, and we look forward to talking with you more.
Thanks a lot, Walt.
You can find out more about the What Wall Street Costs America project and how you can participate by visiting our website at publicbankinginstitute.org. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.